Welcome back to Pet Chat. Greg Richard today, joined by Cheryl Short and Dr. David Tabritz. Great to see you both.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
G'day, Greg.
Well, it's your second chat for the year. This is...
Oh, let's not rub it in. I've been saving up. That's what it's all about. Well, I want to build the suspense.
Less is more is the old saying, I think. So.
Oh, well, in my case, yeah, probably.
And also Badge Watch today.
Yep.
It's two hearts.
Two hearts. We're going to be talking about blood transfusion in pets today, something that David knows a lot about.
See, this is it. I go away for a bit. Suddenly, Cheryl's taken my topics.
Oh.
And you're bombarded.
I'm really looking forward to this, actually. Be interesting.
Oh, good. I'm glad you are. We're another 50 minutes to go.
But we can have calls. It's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've got Mark from New Lambton, and he's got a question about his 9-year-old Shih Tzu. Afternoon, Mark.
Oh, g'day. How are you today?
G'day, Mark. Great. Now, what's going on with your little one?
Well, I put her down on the ground, and she sort of like went into a starfish sort of thing. Legs went out from underneath her, and been up to the vet, and they think that might have had a bit of a stroke, so one eye doesn't blink as much as it should, and we've been given some ointment. But I'm just wondering, is it a permanent type thing, or is it something that you can recover from?
Well, that's an interesting scenario. So I'll just break it down a little bit. I guess the question really, you're talking about stroke as a single disease, right? Because if we ask, can she recover from it, then it's like, do we actually know what's happened? And even if you think about in humans, a stroke is the kind of catch-all name that's given to a couple of different type of events. So the most kind of layman's terms are you have these, blockage of blood flow, or you can have bleeding in blood vessels inside the brain. And both of them can cause these symptoms of neurological damage. But they're obviously, they're going to be two different diseases. And so similarly with dogs, if we go back about, I'm going to say 20, 30 years ago, it was actually thought that dogs don't have strokes. They just don't.
Oh. Yeah, I was unaware of it.
Yeah, but what's happened is the simple reason why we thought that was because nobody actually looked for them. And part of the reason we weren't looking for them is because you need to use things like MRI and CT angiograms where you're putting dye through the blood vessels, and then these things show up. And these are the routine diagnostics that are used for people. So as soon as we started to do that with dogs, when the costs of these technologies became more available, and we did start to find these episodes of neurological disease that were explained by alterations in blood flow. And that's kind of coming back full circle to the definition with people. Now, the thing in dogs is we've found that there are a number of conditions that can cause these neurological injuries with blood vessel problems. So some of those are treatable and some probably less so. Again, it depends on what's actually caused it. And the other thing is, I'm saying the disease that causes the neurological injury may be treatable, but what about the neurological injury itself? Can it recover? And again, if we go back probably further, 50 years, it was thought if you had brain injury, that's it, you don't recover because the brain doesn't heal itself. But in fact, we know that the brain can and does heal itself, and it'll start to form new pathways, new connections. So I think your dog can recover, but I guess the question is, are we going to see ongoing episodes or problems related to whatever the underlying disease is? And so things like you described the eye and not blinking, and that's because there will be an injury to the nerves that control the muscles around the eye. And so we want to make sure the eye itself stays protected. So ointment's a really good idea. It's not treating the underlying disease, but it's making sure that we don't get other problems arising from it. But over time, yes, the brain can recover. And the good thing about dogs is we don't ask them to go and drive a car. We don't ask them to solve a cryptic crossword and, more complex things that would be a measure of brain function, say, in people. Really, what do we want a 9-year-old Shih Tzu to do you know, and can they do that? So it comes down to assessing quality of life. And certainly we will see dogs that recover to the extent that you think, well, they're pretty much okay. You know, maybe they're not perfect, but, you know, they're getting around okay. So I think, yes, they can, but the kind of caveat on that is just wondering what the actual underlying cause is. So it's worth keeping very close contact with your vet about this and follow up regularly, as they, you know, might suggest a schedule of recheck appointments. And because there are different treatments that can be used at different times, and obviously if there's new symptoms develop, then you need to get back to them as soon as possible.
All right. You've explained it very well. Thank you very much.
No worries. Thanks, Mark. See ya.
Bye.
Haven't missed the trick.
I have been practicing for months. See, that's what I did not set up that question, but thanks, Mark, for the call. And I hope your little one gets better soon.
And Cheryl, we're looking at blood fusions today.
Yeah, blood transfusions. You know, it's something that a lot of us don't even give a thought about our pets. We think about it for ourselves and it saves our lives, but it can also save our pets' lives as well. So it's really important to understand that sometimes your dog maybe or your cat may get hit by a car, or there may be surgery. There may be a host of other things as well, like the dog may or cat may have blood disease. It may have another disease that's having trouble, you know, with its blood. And then what happens? You go to the vet and the dog is going to need, or the cat is going to need, a blood transfusion. And we don't often think about this. We just think, oh, we'll go to the vet and the vet will, you know, fix up our pet.
Yep.
But they require blood. And how that happens is that we need donors to give blood. So just like in the human element.
I was just about to ask, do they have like a lineup of pets getting blood donations? And
sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, David. Yeah. So you obviously have in your clinic or your hospital, yeah, you have to have blood on hand yeah, all of the time because you're an emergency. So yep, how do you get it? Do you have it there, or do you have a blood bank, or just how does it actually happen?
So there's a bit of a difference between dogs and cats.
Yes.
So for dogs, apart from the obvious.
Newsflash.
We've got that one. Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm here.
Good.
So for dogs, yes, you're correct. We might have donors on a schedule. One of the things about blood as a product is it expires.
Yeah, it's got a very short life.
Very short life. So we have to throw it out.
Oh, what a waste.
After about 28 to 30 days. And in fact, the effectiveness of it starts to deteriorate closer to the end of that, you know, 21 days or so, or 3 weeks. It becomes less effective, mm-hmm, as a product. So that obviously means we need to continually have this refilling of the stock. And it will depend on the time of the year, whether,
yes,
you know, how many we might need over the course of the year. So, for instance, with snake bites, for instance, we'll see dogs that need blood transfusion with snake bites. And that's obviously got a seasonal influence. For things like trauma, you mentioned, yes, in the start about being hit by a car, bleeding, things like that. That might occur at a different time of the year. So that would help to guide what we have in stock. Apart from our own donors, there are blood banks that we can call on and get deliveries of blood, packed red blood cells, they're called.
And blood in humans is very different than blood in dogs and cats, because they have a lot of different types of blood.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
how do you know which is going to be the right one? Is it like us, it's going to be an A and a B, or do you have to do blood matching, or what actually happens there?
Well, yes and yes to all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It is quite different. And in fact, for dogs, though, we do have the advantage that, and this is kind of gets into the weeds a little bit, it's called immunological, you know, compatibility,
mm-hmm,
so that you don't transfuse the wrong blood. And for dogs, we can actually use there's a blood type called the universal donor. And it's just so happens that most greyhounds have the blood type that makes them a universal donor.
Ah.
And there's another advantage of using greyhounds. Well, there's quite a few. One is they're a pretty big dog.
Yep.
Second one is they're pretty docile.
Mm-hmm.
Like they'll lie there to be a donor. And the third one is their blood is quite concentrated. So it has a high quantity of, or concentration of, hemoglobin, which carries the oxygen.
Ah.
So greyhounds are fantastic as blood donors.
And what other breeds? I mean, you know, if you're looking at, say you have a pet and you think, gee, I'd really like to get on a program of helping out. What's the criteria for a dog, say?
usually the biggest criteria is their size, because, you know, for a little dog, and we take a standard volume as part of the donation, but for a little dog, that might just be too much.
Yes.
So we're going to say, look, you've got to be over 20 or 25 kilos straight away. And then they often apply, say, an age range, like they've got to be adult. And then usually, depending on the program, to be honest, I can't remember what ours is, there's an upper limit for their age. Like, just because the incidence of
Health diseases and things like that would come into factor.
And then they need to be kept up to date on vaccinations, usually in good health, obviously. We always do a little blood test before we collect the blood to make sure that they can actually donate.
Yeah. You know? And would that be the same in cats as well, the same sort of thing? You're wanting a calm cat and cat that's not going to sort of start freaking out?
Well, cats are – this is where they are quite different, because cats have what's called naturally occurring autoantibodies. So if you get a blood donation and it's the first one you've ever had, your body will eventually will create antibodies to the donation. And that's why we try to cross-match and make it a compatible one, so that it's not going to stimulate much of an immune response. But cats already walk around with antibodies against other
cats.
Yeah, other blood types that are not theirs. And so as soon as I transfuse into that cat, I might actually trigger a reaction. And the reaction could be death. So we approach cats with quite a different treatment plan and make sure they're absolutely compatible. We do cross-matching and so on. And there are some cat breeds that carry different blood types. Like, we'll see many of the Asian variety cats, like Siamese, Burmese and so on, have a certain blood type, and whereas your domestic short hairs generally will be of a different type, so that we try not to cross those over.
Okay, that's interesting. And I thought too that it was really interesting. You always think that humans lead the way in health, but the first blood transfusion that was ever done wasn't done between two humans. It was actually done between dogs back in 1665, and I just thought that was amazing.
I did not know that.
Okay, so there you go, Dave.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
1665?
Yeah.
Was it the reasoning for it that they were just testing to see if they could do it, or?
Well, I don't know what the vet's actual opinion was at that time, but obviously...
I don't think there were many vets around in 1665, but...
Richard Lower.
Oh, you got a name?
Yeah, Richard Lower, yeah.
Oh, I wish I'd done the homework.
But I just thought that was so keen. I mean, I don't agree with a lot of things with, you know, testing on animals. You know, this is sort of a thing that we've got to really make sure that any testing that is done is being done for the right reasons. But knowing that our blood transfusions came out of two dogs being transfused is how it led the way a long time ago.
Well, the other way, vets always look at it and say, we will only take a treatment after it's been tested on a human. We don't want to damage our pets. So.
That's true. That's very true. Yeah.
That's very good to know. All those people had flea testing on them all those years ago.
I know. Well, true. You can obviously be infected by dog and cat fleas, but yeah.
Okay, I was just doing a joke, but right.
No,
that's true. That does still happen in South Africa and places like that. They get bitten by fleas very badly and disease happens.
Oh, yeah, hang out in some houses in vet hospitals, I think you'll get bitten by fleas.
And, David, there's something you want to talk about. I guess it's been in the news recently, hasn't Cheryl?
Yes, it has. About 3 weeks ago they had a topic on the parvovirus.
Yes, yep.
What is parvovirus, for those uninitiated?
So parvovirus, obviously the name indicates the family of viruses, and the reason why I highlight that simple part is because there are parvoviruses in other species, including people. But what we want to actually focus on, completely different virus, canine parvovirus, attacks rapidly growing cells in dogs. Now, if you're a really young puppy, like a week old, and you get parvovirus, the organ that gets attacked is the heart muscle, because it is the muscle that is growing, the organ that's growing the fastest.
Yep.
And so they end up with really severe heart disease. But what we tend to see is in young dogs that don't have a solid immunity, a against parvovirus. It attacks the lining of the gut because the gut is constantly turning over the surface. The cells are being replaced all the time, and it's those rapidly growing cells that the virus likes to get into because that helps the virus to rapidly replicate.
Yep.
And in the process, the virus doesn't care what it does. And so what happens is the cells, the lining of the gut get killed off and they come away and the gut starts to bleed. They can absorb bacteria and toxins and it causes intense abdominal pain, vomiting, diarrhea, to the extent that it can be fatal. So we're seeing it in these younger animals. I have seen it in a dog that was about 15 months of age. Usually by that stage, most dogs would have immunity mostly, and we would encourage this through vaccination.
Yep.
So that's why it's so important to ensure that, for instance, if you're breeding a dog, that you make sure you speak to your vet before you even go ahead with the breeding, that we want to make sure the immunity is up to date, because then the mother will transmit the immunity through to the pups through the milk, and that's how they get this initial immunity that covers them to protect them against that heart muscle disease. But that level of immunity through the milk, that maternal antibody transfer through the milk, that starts to wear off after about maybe 5, 6, 7 weeks, something like that. And so that's when we need to start the vaccination process, around that 6 to 8 weeks. And to give full immunity, which involves different immunoglobulins in the immune system, we need to give them a series of vaccinations, usually with the last vaccine occurring at or after around 15 weeks. So vaccination will help to prevent this, as will clean environment and obviously not mixing with dogs that you're not sure about, and just paying attention to the fact that young dogs, young pups and so on, are most susceptible. So it is a treatable disease, and the treatment is pretty successful. I'm going to say 90 to 95% successful with treatment. But it can be, obviously, you know, they're in hospital for a period of time. Going back to what we were talking earlier about transfusions, some of those dogs will need blood transfusions. Some will need plasma transfusions, along with a whole host of other treatments. So far better to prevent the disease in the first place with vaccination.
So with vaccination, would... just say you've just got a brand new puppy or you've brought a new dog, would, in your first trip to the vet, they would recommend that straight away, or they'll give you, they'll just do it?
Pretty much you're going to have that conversation, which is, here's the vaccine schedule, here's the assessment of risk factors. The best thing we can do is to start the vaccinations at the appropriate age. So it could be that 6 to 8 weeks. And then we'll lay out the next vaccine's going to be 4 weeks down the track and so on. And so once we go through that, we're probably covering, you know, 99% of dogs will respond to the vaccine, or even higher, 99.9% will respond to the vaccine and have protection. And so then they need a follow-up 12 months later.
Right. Okay then. It's Batchat on 2NURFM. We've got to go a couple of calls. We've got Dawn from Singleton, and she's got a 5-month pup and a 12-year-old Staffy, both just peeing all over the house at the moment.
Yeah.
Hey Dawn, sounds...
I've already trained my pup, but not helping.
So is your 12-year-old Staffy trained, house trained?
Trained, yeah, fully house trained. But because he's smelling his male scent, he's peeing on top of him.
So who's the male, the pup?
They're both males.
They're both males. Are they is the older one de-sexed?
No.
Well, I think you're correct in your assessment that the smelling the scent and so on.
Yeah.
The question is around...
Nothing.
Sorry, I missed that.
Tried vinegar and I've even tried pepper. It won't work.
Right. So the question is, other factors related to house training your pup, but you've got this complication of the older dog now kind of messing up any training, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
This can get quite difficult, and I would suggest certainly talking to your vet about a strategy. The short answer is going to be utilising the things that we always talk about, making sure that particularly the pup is going out first thing in the morning, last thing at night, after every meal, having areas that you can block off so that they're just not walking around the house peeing everywhere. Secondly, I would say we need to separate them a bit more.
A bit more, you think?
Yeah, yeah. And putting them on a lead and getting them to do responses to your, you know, requests, can sit, stay, etc., using food as a reward to get them distracted, because at the moment, and I'm not sure what the arrangement is with the various rooms and so on, but at the moment they're kind of ignoring your presence altogether.
Well, over the day they're fine because they're sort of he's out, one's out, one's in, but it's when I get up, I let them out in the morning and they've peed before I get up at daylight. They've peed before because it's cold. I'm a bit of a spoil. I spoil them. I don't like them out in the cold.
No, fair enough, fair enough. So where are they staying at night though?
Inside. I let them in about 10:30, 11 at night, and I'm usually up at 5, 6 in the morning to let them out.
So inside, like they've got the run of the house?
One's in the lounge, one's in my bed, the pug's spoiled in my bed, but the other one's in the lounge room.
We might need to look at trying to set them up, and this is why I mentioned about going to see your vet, because it is starting to – two dogs always makes problems, right? And I've got two dogs that are the same age, so, you know, I'm guilty of this, all the mistakes you can make, we've made them. But the run of the house thing – I'm going to suggest looking at crate training because they won't pee in their bed if that's all they've got.
I had him in a pen, a knitted pen, all closed in, and he was peeing in it badly, worse than now.
What, the puppy was?
Pen off him, he's not peeing as bad.
But
just once that they'll pee.
I would also speak to your vet about whether or not there's some medical problem as well, because most dogs will try to stay fairly clean, but if they've got a big space to move about in, like most of the house, then they're literally just ignoring you and thinking, well, this is our space, we'll do what we like.
I've trained a female and a male, and they're fine, but it's because they're two males, so he's been smelling the young one and he's just marking on top.
Yeah, and de-sexing the younger one may make a difference to this scenario as well. That's the other strategy. Did you have another dog? Is it just the two?
I've only got two.
Okay.
A Staffy and a Chihuahua for years.
Right, okay.
And I trained it perfectly, but it was female and male, see, so they weren't marking.
Yeah, it is going to, the testosterone is going to be driving some of this behaviour, but it's more than that. Okay, so
he's not cocking his leg to pup all.
No, he's still too young for that. But I think you need to restrict the amount of space that they've got. You can put a pee pad down. They might ignore that.
Pee's next to it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But it's really about getting the discipline for the timing and getting the discipline for the space, and then starting to do other things in terms of obedience or at least control that you're in charge, like I mentioned, on the lead, doing exercises for you, will start to re-establish that.
I used to train him so he's right. You know, he's naughty. Yeah, that's how I usually train him, with paper, the noise, and that frightens him.
Yeah, I'd still probably go and speak to the vet about other strategies, or an animal behaviourist will give you some help, more specific advice in your environment. So it's a tough one though. So keep at it. He's only young and I think you'll get there.
It's Pet Chat on 2NURFM 103.7. And just wrapping up, we've got a couple of pets of the week. We've got a cat, Clover, who's looking for a first home, about 4 year old as well, past a kitten year. So she's looking pretty good, you'd have to say, Cheryl.
Yeah, she does look pretty nice. And out of that kitten stage, that'll make a nice pet for somebody.
Right, because you don't want to... Well, I suppose unless you want a kitten, then you'd be all over it. But
kittens can be hard work, but, you know, a more mature cat can fit into a family quite nicely.
And our dog of the week is Lucy Lou, a bit of a Jack Russell Terrier cross. So 1 year old, so probably still a bit of puppy training maybe?
Absolutely. They are full of energy. We were just chatting before during the song about looking at Lucy Lou. She's got a lot of energy.
They are very exciting.
Yeah. Dogs. Needs a family that's got a lot of, you know, activity going on, so she can be part of that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just do laps of the house.
Yeah, very loyal.
Yeah.
Very loyal, but and they'll chase the rats.
Excellent.
Yeah. an easy maintenance dog as well there. I mean, that little dog doesn't take a lot of care, so you haven't got things like, you know, massive grooming and things like that that you've got to do. So just a wash and a dry and a little bit of a brush and all's easy.
Are they known for that, chasing rats?
Yeah, that's what they were bred for.
Oh.
Back in the UK.
Well, there you go.
That was their thing.
A little fun fact at the end of the show with. Well, Cheryl and David, thank you very much.
Cheers. Thanks,
Greg. My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.